Welcome to Chapter 2, A Conversation with Staunton Lind.
I have a funny story to tell you. In the Youngstown struggle when the mills closed, there came a moment when U.S. Steel said, well, Judge, we got this order from you when you're going to have a hearing. We just want you to know we'll be closing the mill the previous week. And the judge, maybe not. And we decided that we should go up to Cleveland and make a case that U.S. Steel wouldn't be allowed to shut down until there'd been a trial. And the legal team that was to argue this was me and Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, who'd gone radical. And I will never in my life forget Clark, who was this very sort of big, gangly man, getting up and saying, well, Judge, we need to start with the 1877 railroad strike. And half an hour or 45 minutes later, he got up to 1919. And the judge finally very timidly said, well, General, that's what he called a former attorney general. He addressed him as General. General, don't we need to say something about this case?
That was Staunton Lind. I spent a few afternoons with Staunton trying to better understand the implications of the 1877 railroad strike. After being fired from history faculty at Yale, he taught with Howard Zinn at Spielman. He then, along with his wife Alice, became a lawyer, and they would end up representing steelworker unions in the Midwest. They've also written quite a few books. I thought he'd be a good person to help put this event into perspective, but he did not want to talk about 1877. Instead, he wanted to talk about another strike, the 1937 Little Steel Strike. Most historians think the Little Steel Strike was a failure. The workers did not get a contract, a guaranteed wage for work. But Staunton does not think the strike was a failure. Interestingly, the workers themselves also did not see the strike as a failure. They did not get a contract, but the factories were forced to recognize the unions, and the unions could still strike. They might not have a guaranteed wage, but management was going to listen to them if anything was going to get done. They were going to be partners. The workers were going to be able to exert some sort of control. They preserved a sense of ownership. And the sense of ownership the workers felt and demanded is something largely lost from the concept of work and work relations today. Staunton is going to read from two books. The first will be an anthology of oral histories, rank and file, edited by himself and Alice. The second will be Ahmad White, The Last Great Strike. A few things before we head off. First, I did try to get Alice to sit for interviews, yet she had kept needing to miss our conversations to work on urgent legal briefs. And secondly, Staunton talks at his own pace. Stick with him. I think the story he wants to tell about the shift in the paradigm around notions of work and ownership is worth hearing.
In March 1937, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee of the CIO entered into a contract with U.S. Steel. And this contract, a contract was acceptable to John L. Lewis, the president of the United Mine Workers, who proceeded to require in CIO contracts two essential features. One of them was the so-called management prerogatives clause. We can talk about wages, hours, and working conditions, but not about fundamental investment decisions, so that if the employer wants to shut down Factory A, there's nothing that the union can do about it except to negotiate shutdown benefits, what my friends here in Youngstown used to call burial arrangements. And then the second key contractual provision, and the one that most concerns us, the no-strike clause, which was extended from the very beginning to cover more than strikes, also slowdowns, and tie the hands of workers on the shop floor where such a contract existed.
If you're in a union today, you negotiate for pay and working conditions, but you don't get a say in the direction of the company. This is actually true of most workers in general. There's almost no sense in which you have ownership over the company. That's management. And that separation is new. Staunton is going to read an account of a strike that most historians consider a failure, but the workers did not. They did not get a contract, a guaranteed set wage for work, but they did get to keep their power to strike. The company was forced to recognize the unions, thus giving them power over the way in which the factory run itself, in a sense, keeping a sense of ownership over the direction of the factory and the company.
I'll read you the account of John Sargent, who was the president of the CIO local at the time. Little Steel, which was Youngstown Sheet and Tube, Republic Steel, Inland Steel, and other independent companies had no contract with the Steel Workers Union. As a result, in 1937, there was a strike called on Little Steel. And one of the things that happened during the strike was the massacre in South Chicago, the Chicago cops beating and shooting the people. The strike was not won. We did not win a contract. Neither Youngstown Sheet and Tube, nor Republic Steel, nor Inland Steel won a contract with the company. What they did get was an agreement through the governor's office that the company would recognize the Steelworkers Union and the company union and any other organization that wanted to represent the people in the steel industry. And we went back to work with this government's agreement signed by various companies and union representatives in Indiana. We had no contract with the company, but the enthusiasm of the people who were working the mills made this settlement of the strike a victory of great proportion. And only recently did I come upon this book just published and a fragment of evidence that I think really seals the deal on John Sargent's account is evidence that the author of the book doesn't know how to deal with. But nevertheless, he says it. On July 1st, Inland reopened the Indiana Harbor Mill. Amid cries of victory from thousands of workers, some sporting beards that they had vowed to grow until the strike ended, the daily worker joined the chorus, likening the triumph to the victory of the patriots over British tyranny, and so on. In other words, the people most concerned, the people who had been on strike, apparently regarded a victory, and to repeat myself, the essence of the victory. There was no CIO contract. As a result, there was no strike clause. As a result, as problems arose on the shop floor, people were free to deal with them through direct action. And so that's a rough outline of why this particular historical episode is so central for me. And this talk of John's, from which I quoted, was in 1970, almost 50 years ago. And people still don't have a clue. I mean, I said, listen.
Notice the buildings around you. They are changing. Old factories and warehouses are becoming luxury apartments, craft breweries, and office spaces for tech startups. Staunton Lind is talking about a paradigm shift that happened in the way work was understood a century ago. Looking at the architecture around you, it seems clear that another shift is happening again. Couple things seem to me sort of interesting and obvious, and that the combination of not being able to strike and the combination of managerial retained rights to make managerial decisions is that it separates the worker from any leverage of ownership at all.
Precisely.
In reading about a lot of the earlier strikes, is a notion that the workers felt a very hard sense of ownership around the factory.
Yeah, and you're talking about the Homestead strike. Yeah. And my understanding, and I think yours, is that the workers were still the people who made things. And the management would say to the representative of the open hearth workers or whoever, skilled artisans, how much of a certain kind of steel do you think you can give us in so-and-so period of time? And the guy in overalls, dirty from head to foot, would have an answer. And so that got put into the message to the customer. Well, yeah, we can do that. We make the best steel in the world, and you can have it by September 1st. And what changed at the Homestead strike was essentially that whole meaning of work changed. And it wasn't very long after that that Taylor came along and said, yeah, and the most efficient way to do it is if each worker does only one operation throughout the shift. And I think that was the fundamental change. And a curious thing, there's all this literature about the proletariat, but very often you find that the real struggle with any vision, the real down and dirty conflict, was when they took that artisanal control away from working people and put it in the hands of college kids who didn't know how to make the thing to begin with. Yeah, American companies just lost the intuitive knowledge that the person who actually makes something, you hold it in your hands, you feel it in your fingers, and you know it in a way that nobody else can know it.
We've gone through a paradigm shift mentally in looking at labor conflicts, and we can no longer really grasp the worldview of workers before the paradigm shift. And so when we look at Homestead strike of 1892, people look at it as a dollar and cents issue. And to a certain extent, that is true, and it was a dollar and cents issue. But at the heart of 1892, and I don't know that people are really grasped that, at the heart of the issue was who is going to have a say in running the business. Samuel Lubell was a political scientist, long since dead, but he wrote extensively on political change in America and labor politics in the 1930s. And he said he would go into, in the late 1930s, to a local United Auto Workers union hall in Detroit. It would be like some kind of a revolutionary cell. You know, the head of the local union would be in his leather jacket, and he'd be kicked back with his feet up on the desk. On the bulletin boards, had photographs of battles with the police and picket lines and everything like that. And the local union chief would be very hostile towards him, suspicious because he's a newspaper reporter. And of course, you're going to lie about us, you know. And he says, it looks like this is an insurgent movement. 10 years later, to the very same Detroit United Auto Workers Hall, talk to the very same union president, and he would be dressed in a suit and tie. There would be pictures on the bulletin boards, picnics and outings and things like that, and bowling leagues, and it looked very sedate. And you'd say, what the hell happened to the labor movement? How? And all across America, commentators were saying, what happened to the vitality of the labor movement? You know, millions were on the march in the 1930s. Were they just marching for a better wage? Marching so they could go out and have picnics on a Sunday? Is that what it was all for? Well, to a certain extent, it was. And that is why people like Stoughton are, who's a good friend of mine, but that's why he's disappointed in the labor movement. It didn't turn out to be as revolutionary as one might have hoped.
You should now be standing on the sidewalk on Smallman Street near the 31st Street Bridge. Look towards the river. You should be looking at a large, recently renovated factory building. This large industrial building with new windows and a roof is the Crucible Building. This building served as Crucible Steel's headquarters until 1952. Crucible Steel was formed from the merger of 13 Crucible Steel companies in 1900. By 1939, Crucible was one of the largest producers of tool steel in the United States, making over 400 products. Now, this is office space. Its sole occupant, Uber. This building and its change of occupants is a great reminder that the nature of work is undergoing dramatic change. The 1877 railroad strike happened at a time of great technological and economic transformation, one that took years of bloody conflict, organizing, and eventual governmental intervention to force society to share the advances of the new age with the general population. We're at that point again, and there's no better stand-in or metaphor for thinking about the current technological and economic transformation of artificial intelligence, machine learning, automation, the gig economy, etc., than Uber. More than just critiquing Uber, we need to ask bigger questions about what is coming. What is the new economy? Who benefits from work? Staunton's desire to talk about the 1937 steel strike stems from a belief that the nature of work has changed, that what mattered to the workers was a sense of ownership that they had in the company, a sense of ownership gone from how workers even think about their place of work today. Not only is this an important notion around the idea of work, something to keep in mind, but the discussion also points to another point, that work and ownership are malleable and changing. We need to think about work again. It's already shifting and changing, and the consequences of the new developing paradigm will extend well beyond the jobs themselves to the kind of world we want to live in. For Chapter 3, I would like you to walk from this building to the home of Uber Advanced Technologies Group, a short walk away. You will head down Smallman Street, go under the bridge, and turn left on 32nd Street. Walk all the way to the end. Please be careful. The sidewalk will disappear. It will only reappear when you finally arrive at Uber's building at the end of the road. When you're ready, press the next track for Chapter 3 and begin walking.